From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Get vaccinated. That's the message today in Mississippi and Tennessee from First Lady Jill Biden. She and country star Brad Paisley are touring vaccination sites in Jackson and Nashville to encourage people to get inoculated. The state of Tennessee has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, with about 40% of people having received a single dose. Only 35% are fully vaccinated. And nationwide, kids 12 to 17 years old, the group that needs parental approval to get shots, is also seeing a lag in inoculations. Fewer than a third have had a single dose. Well, for more on why this matters, let's bring in Dr. Peter Hotez from the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development and Baylor College. And Dr. Hotez joins us via Skype. Welcome back.
No, thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you for being here. We were reading a recent UK study that shows the surge there is fueled by children who are 5 times more likely to test positive. Here in the United States, how do you explain the low numbers among children? What's stopping parents from going ahead with the shots?
Well, particularly in adolescents, and it varies by country. So as you pointed out, fewer than 10% of the adolescents 12 to 17 are immunized in states like Louisiana and Mississippi. It's much better up in the Northeast. So it very much varies geographically. And this is important because what we've seen with the Delta variant in the UK is a lot of young people getting sick. You know, as the older individuals have become vaccinated, it leaves the younger groups much more vulnerable. So I'm worried potentially about a big surge this summer like we saw last summer, but a bit different in that lots of unvaccinated young people, especially in the southern United States, are going to get sick and be hospitalized.
I want to talk more about that, but I first want to talk with you about these rare vaccine side effects in the under 30 age group, and that's heart inflammation. The CDC is reporting about 300 cases of a condition out of more than 20 million vaccinations, no fatalities. Can you explain what this is?
Yeah, so, well, increasingly it looks like there is a relationship between what's being called myocarditis or pericarditis, inflammation of the heart or the sac around the heart, and COVID-19 in vaccinations in young people, although I still point out it's far lower than the rates of those same conditions, myocarditis, pericarditis, in young people who actually get COVID-19. So it's only a fraction of that. But the CDC is going to be looking at this. So the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, is scheduled to meet tomorrow, I believe, to have a full discussion of it. Right. Increasingly, it looks like there is an association, but again, quite rare, as you point out, 300 cases out of 20 million. What is that, about 1 in 70,000? So I think that's what we have to keep in mind. And myocarditis from COVID-19 among young people is quite high. The University of Michigan did a study a while back showing that a significant number, I think it was 2 to 3% of infected athletes, had significant heart issues because of myocarditis due to COVID-19. So that's the piece to keep in mind.
Do you think that the CDC will change any recommendations based on their findings during this meeting tomorrow?
I don't think so, given that it's rare and it's so far more common with the actual virus. So so it's all about risk versus benefit. And given the fact that we're about to see Delta variant rip through the South and other parts of the country where lots of people are not vaccinated, I think we'll have to keep that in mind, because what we'll see is a lot of young people with the Delta variant getting myocarditis and many other conditions, including long-haul COVID, neurologic sequelae. So that's going to be the consideration.
You know, I have only about 30 seconds with you, but what's your message for parents who are hearing all of this and they're just worried as they go into the summer?
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of questions about it. I say if it gives you some comfort, it's just another day before ACIP meets and you'll have we'll have some additional clarification. I said if the ACIP wasn't meeting for weeks, I would go ahead and recommend getting your adolescent kid vaccinated, or if you're a young adult, getting vaccinated. If you want to wait one extra day, I think it's okay. But remember, this Delta variant is coming because it'll take 2 doses, 5 weeks to get fully immunized.
Dr. Peter Hotez from Baylor University, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And let's get some perspective now on yesterday's Supreme Court ruling that college athletes can get unlimited compensation with benefits related to their education, things like grad school scholarships and paid internships. Our next guest says the ruling will only intensify what he calls the unsustainable spending arms race in college sports. Tom McMillan is CEO of Lead One Association. It's a group that represents athletic departments at many of the biggest schools in the country. He's a former NBA player and former U.S. Congressman from Maryland. He's on Skype. Tom, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And first of all, why do you disagree with yesterday's Supreme Court decision that would allow some compensation to student athletes?
It's not that I disagree. Listen, I think educational expenses should be covered. The question will be in the details. When they say unlimited, what does that mean? Is that a $100,000 postgraduate internship, you know, pay for medical school, law school for all your family? We just don't know the sort of the definitions yet. Listen, it's inevitable that student athletes are going to bargain for more rights, particularly when the management side is taking extraordinary salaries. Coaches make lots of money. And this day was inevitably going to come. I wrote about it when I was in Congress back in the 90s in my book Out of Bounds. I said, if you don't slow down the arms race on the enterprise side, expect an arms race for student athletes. And that's what
we have. Let's stop there. What is this arms race exactly that you're talking about? And how does this ruling make it worse or could make it worse?
You know, in the last 3 years, there's been $300 million of buyouts of coaches who failed, who literally fired. It's the tremendous cost of facility growth across our campuses. Coaches are generally the highest paid employee in the state. It's the whole idea that there's no real way to control cost in college sports. Like the NBA and the NFL, they have mechanisms to restrain spending. We do not have that in college sports. So without that, you're going to see an arms race on the student athlete side.
Well, I want to talk about the potential solutions here in just a moment. But first, I know you're well aware of the argument that the athletes are making, that schools are making billions of dollars off of them. Some come from low-income families. Here's Ramogi Huma, a former football player for UCLA, now with the National College Players Association, speaking to NPR's Morning Edition today. He was describing what happened to a former teammate of his. Let's listen.
Someone left groceries anonymously on his doorstep, and the NCAA punished him. They suspended him. He didn't even know the groceries were left on his doorstep. Didn't know that his roommate had taken the groceries in, but it didn't matter to the NCAA. But he was from a low-income background. They're selling his jersey in the store, and the NCAA says, well, we'd rather have you hungry than to have any groceries because of our rules.
So I just wonder if you can sympathize with the argument that the athletes here are making, that the schools are getting paid, and in some cases, you know, they can't even feed themselves.
I'm totally understand Ramogi's point, and I understand where the student athlete's coming from. Without curtailment on the business side, you are going to have this demand for rights for student athletes, and rightfully so. Even our athletic directors understand that point. What I'm trying to say is look down the road 10 years from now. Is it doubling down and giving student athletes market-based compensation, which is where we're heading, or is it curtail some of the excesses? Have Congress give college sports tools so they can control costs. And so what our athletic directors want, 96% of them surveyed said this, is they would love to have some way to constrain costs. And by the way, I am the first to defend student athletes' rights to bargain and to have a fair shake. But the reason why this has happened is because the whole enterprise has gotten out of control.
I mean, let's be specific about what some of those controls might look like. I mean, as you know, Congress hasn't gotten very far on legislation that would allow athletes to make money off of their fame, their name, their image, their likeness. Six states have already come up with laws that are coming into effect on July 1st on that issue. The NCAA is scrambling to come up with national guidelines. I mean, tell me more what a specific policy prescription would look like from Congress. I mean,
it's a very good question. A good part of it has to be enhancing the student-athlete benefits, making sure they're better protected on health care and safety and all those things. You know, letting them have name, image, and likeness rights. Those are things that should be done. and are slowly being done, but I understand the impatience is not being done fast enough. On the other side of the coin, the conferences, the college football playoff, and the NCAA, they distribute $4 billion a year to their schools. With that money, they can make college sports look like whatever they want it to look like. The point is that the college sports is so fragmented, the leadership is so fragmented, that they can't come together on sensible ideas to make college sports look like higher education, be congruent with higher education, and take care of student athletes at the same time. And the fact of the matter is, the whole enterprise really is at fault.
Tom McMillan is CEO of Lead One Association, represents athletic departments of the top football programs in the United States, also a former congressman and NBA player. Mr. McMillan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Remember the days when you could get a Lyft or an Uber, sometimes in as little as 2 minutes? Those were the pre-pandemic days when many drivers were available. But now many of you are asking, where is my Uber? And why is it so expensive? Drivers are feeling this crunch too. They aren't getting a big cut of those higher fares. Jonathan Panzer is a Lyft driver in Austin, Texas, and he joins us now. And Jonathan, when I spoke with you last year, you were driving for Lyft full-time after losing your job in a nonprofit sector because of the pandemic. Now you're back into nonprofit work and you're actually still driving, just less. How has the experience changed over the last year?
Well, since we last spoke, I believe in September, it's actually gotten very much, much busier, not surprisingly. Demand is definitely up, especially in Austin. And income was up. Actually, I got a job back in May, but in March, April, and May, I was averaging in the low 2000s a week for really good money down here. And even though I have a full-time job working for a nonprofit, I still am driving because Austin has become so expensive over the past couple of years that you have to have multiple jobs if you're working in the nonprofit sector.
Uber and Lyft have been dealing with this driver shortage throughout the pandemic. But it's really coming to a head now that more people are going out, as you're seeing directly as you're out on the road. As a driver, what is the experience like? Are you feeling this rush when you're out on the road?
Absolutely.
There are times, certain days during the week, especially Friday through Sunday, where you could basically go nonstop for 6 or 7 hours without having a break. Either you have somebody in your car or you're going to get somebody, which is great because you're maximizing your earning potential. You're not burning gas. You're not wasting time looking for a ride, but it's also exhausting because you don't have a break. You have to be on the entire time. And you also have to deal with the passengers who sometimes, unfortunately, don't realize that there's a pandemic still going on. And you have to kind of negotiate and navigate that system as well.
The driver shortage plus skyrocketing demand means that fares are also going up. We know that Uber decoupled driver earnings from the price customers pay at the start of the pandemic. Lyft actually did that back in 2016. Have you talked to other drivers? How are they feeling about all of this? And how are you feeling about this? It sounds like you are actually making good money at this time, but it is a stressful time for those drivers who drive full time.
Absolutely. And I will
say this as somebody who needed to get a Lyft this past weekend after the Austin FC soccer match. It took me an hour and a half to get a ride. And I can definitely feel the frustration, especially the evening drivers and the evening passengers. At the end of the day, what the customer pays isn't as relevant to me as how much I make per ride. And if I feel like that's a justifiable rate, then as a driver, I have to look at that and say, you know what, that's okay with that. You can always ask the passenger what they're paying, and then you can show them what you're getting, kind of figure it out from there. But at the end of the day, a driver has to look out for the driver. And as much as we want to take care of our passengers, it's a job and we need to look after our bottom line.
Will you continue driving Lyft?
Oh, absolutely.
The money is too good, and I work in the nonprofit sector. I did start my own company, a tour company in Austin, but I will always drive with Lyft just because, especially in Austin, how expensive the city is getting, and it's pushing more and more of us native Austinites out. I need to do what I can to survive. I haven't had a day off since the day before MLK Day last year, so it's been a long grind. But if this is the only way that we can survive in town, then we got to do what we got to do.
That's Jonathan Panzer, a Lyft driver in Austin, Texas. Jonathan, I'm so happy to hear this update from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's great to hear from you too.
Well, let's take a deeper look at the state of Uber and Lyft with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
Hey, how are you?
I am well. Nice to talk with you. Well, as we heard from Jonathan, some Uber and Lyft drivers are feeling the stress of this higher demand. Why are ride-hailing services having such a hard time keeping up?
You know, as you and I have discussed in so many prior segments, there's been no shortage of unhappiness in this neck of the gig working woods. I have personally never met an elated Uber driver. You know, you're weighing the benefit of choice and freedom and self-determination. That's being counteracted by the app as a boss, and it wants its cut, too often without actual HR benefits. Add to this a year of having to share tight quarters with, you know, as Jonathan said, unmasked passengers, their surging gasoline costs, and general rust and malaise from the pandemic year. And you have a harder time meeting the snapback in demand that we're seeing all across these cities in the economy's broad opening. I think a lot of drivers are reluctant to go back to the old status quo.
Is there also this worker demand problem in this industry? We've heard about industries like restaurants and retail struggling to bring workers back. Is that the same case here?
I think it's analogous. Whether you were let go last spring or took time off to ride out, you know, contagion or the economic demand fallout, you're now coming back, you know, sometimes with enhanced unemployment benefits, wondering if you want to sign up again for that pre-COVID service hustle. In parallel, drivers could be recalculating the cost of their time and really waiting it out for a bigger cut of the take from Uber and Lyft. And many report that the apps are just being too slow and stingy with paying up.
Okay, let's talk about these prices. They have been ridiculously high lately. Some people are paying double what they used to, and cancellations are up because people don't want to pay more. Why are we seeing this surge in the amount that we pay?
There is not enough drivers to meet this snapback in demand. And within that is this vicious cycle of sticker shock and cancellations from users, and then more frustration for drivers who are rethinking whether they want to be in this at all. The research firm Rakuten Intelligence found that the cost of a ride was 40% higher in April than it was a year ago. The apps have been throwing bonus tier incentives at drivers, you know, current and perspective, but they've yet to successfully match demand and supply and bring those prices down. Last month, Uber said that it had 3.5 million active drivers and couriers during the first quarter of 2021, and that's down 22% from the previous year.
Hmm. Can you also explain for us this uncoupling from the price the customer pays and what the driver gets? Help us understand this.
The driver's boss, the app, is, in short, it's taking the bulk of the cut. One Uber driver in Memphis, Tennessee, told The Guardian that his experience over a couple of years taught him, for example, if you take a $10 ride that is surge priced to $30, it will only yield him an extra $2 or $3. And, you know, maybe the passenger in there is sitting and saying, I don't have to tip more because this guy is getting twice or three times as much from what he would normally get. And the quote that he gave at the end of the day, he's only recouping 6 cents over the federal mileage write-off. Too often, these drivers complain, they can't even see what the passengers are paying. So it sometimes helps, as Jonathan says, to have that conversation with your passengers. If people, you know, you're talking about other things such as education and your aspirations for your kids and their kids. Maybe if there's more pricing transparency and compensation transparency, a lot of users would pay more, demand that the apps pay the drivers more to begin with.
What is the latest with that larger push that we've had previous conversations about and getting workers to become declared employees? I mean, after the pandemic, where are we with that specific push?
It's still so uphill. You recall in November when California voters passed the very contentious and heavily TV ad-driven Prop 22 to exempt app-based gig workers from employee rights such as unemployment, health insurance, minimum wage, and collective bargaining. Uber, Lyft, and other gig companies threatened to shut down operations in the state of California if they were forced to treat these gig workers as employees. And the drivers, many in California, have since reported deterioration of conditions and take-home pay. Can it happen in New York, where at the same time taxis are in crisis and there's no love lost from taxi drivers toward Uber drivers? Can you see it happen in maybe more blue, labor-friendly constituent bases? I mean, that's a hugely open question.
What about taxi drivers? They've lost so much business to these ride-hailing services over the years. Are they positioned to step in to offer rides?
Shed many tears for taxi drivers and medallion owners and renters of medallions. A record number lost their livelihoods during the ascent of Uber and Lyft, and it didn't help that so much of commercial Manhattan, for example, was mothballed during COVID. If you take New York City, before the pandemic, there were more than 10,000 yellow cabs in the streets every day. That tanked to less than 1,000 in April 2020, in the thick of the contagion. And it's only come back to about 3,500 per day. You still hear stories of distress among drivers and their families who are barely driving, sometimes at or under cost, just to service the obligations on their medallion. So I imagine that you're going to hear more and more about bailouts for taxis that have been beleaguered, not just by this pandemic, but by the technological disruption of Uber and Lyft, which in turn are seeing driver rebellion. So it is quite messy out there.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the incentives, with a little bit of time I have with you, that the companies are offering to their drivers to stay on the road, specifically Lyft and Uber?
Yeah, they've had to shell out some cash bonuses for drivers or for referring new drivers. Uber in April said it would earmark an extra $250 million to pay driver incentives in the near terms. Uber's drivers in Chicago, Philly, and other cities are now making what they can say is more than twice the hourly minimum wage before the new incentives. But how permanent are these sweeteners going to be when Uber and Lyft are both under significant pressure to be profitable? I think this is a true reckoning for kind of, you know, my cut of the wages, what you're seeing in parallel in restaurants, in stores, and others. I don't want this just to be hero pay or some pandemic bonus. You need to pay me and keep paying me.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you so much, Robin.
Likewise, Tanya. Thank you.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
A national moratorium on evictions is set to expire in just over a week. Meanwhile, Congress has approved more than $46 billion in rental assistance in response to the pandemic, but some eligible renters are finding that accessing that funding isn't always easy. Stephanie Stokes of WABE in Atlanta has one story that speaks to the challenges immigrant families can face.
Irma Otsuna Perez stands at a bus stop in her neighborhood in northeast Atlanta. She has a face mask on and a jacket hood.
Como me verán, como vengo vestida del trabajo.
She says this all-black outfit is her work uniform for cleaning hotels. It's been difficult during the pandemic. She hasn't gotten enough hours, and that caused her to fall behind on rent. Earlier this year, she went to an event for the local rental assistance program run by United Way of Greater Atlanta and thought she could get help. Many applicants were Latinx.
Toda la gente cree cuando uno va a ese evento.
She says everyone at the event was hopeful. A caseworker told her the program would pay her bills in 20 days. But 3 months passed, and that didn't happen. Pratit Biswas is vice president of homelessness at United Way. He says he knows families are in crisis.
Whenever I meet these families, I always wonder, I wish I could respond to them today because that's what they need.
The problem is, this spring, many eligible families fell into a gap in funding. The federal government is giving local governments money in a few rounds. Right when Otsuna Perez applied, United Way ran out of the first round. But Biswas says that doesn't mean families like hers won't get help.
We took all the applications from round one and tried to process them as the first ones in round two.
In Otsuna Perez's case, it's not clear if that happened. She says she didn't receive anything other than a note in English saying there was no more money. An Urban Institute survey found 1 in 5 low-income immigrant families had trouble paying rent at the end of last year. And yet, many immigrant families, especially those with undocumented members, have struggled to get rental assistance, says Catherine McKay. She's at the Aspen Institute, which has studied programs across the country.
Those are households that are likely to be lower income. There's also language barriers and reticence to ask for help.
She says some programs early in the pandemic excluded families with undocumented members. In the latest rounds of rental assistance, there are no such restrictions. And McKay says this money is supposed to reach the people who need it most.
The purpose is to ensure that this recovery is more equitable. That's why there's so much money for social safety net programs and things like emergency rental assistance in the American Recovery Plan.
Protip Biswas acknowledges United Way could do better. He says the organization has advertised on the Spanish language network Telemundo and tried to be flexible with documentation around pay stubs and rental leases. Now the agency has paused applications again because it's received so many, but it's still allowing Spanish-speaking families to apply.
If you apply in Spanish, that site is still open because we want the immigrant group to keep coming in, right?
Otsuna Perez's case is among those applications. United Way caseworkers finally make contact with her landlord.
No lo quiero para como para gastármelo, sino que para pagar.
Otsuna Perez reminds me that is who this money is for. Months behind now, and with late fees, she knows she can only catch up if she gets some help. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes.
If you have a flight booked on American Airlines anytime soon, you might want to take a look at the schedule before you head out to the airport. The airline plans to cancel between 50 and 80 flights every day for the next several weeks. We're going to try to see what's going on here with Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Peter.
And this is already happening. American canceled several hundred flights over the weekend. But before we get to why, what's happening to the customers who've booked these flights?
Yeah, so it's about 1% of their flight. And today, by the way, we're already up to 132 flights, that according to FlightAware data. So it certainly hasn't gotten any better yet. And the tricky thing, Peter, is that we're talking about a time now when flights are no longer empty. So it's harder to reaccommodate customers than it was, say, a year ago, where if a flight canceled, you know, who cared? There was another empty flight. At this point, flights, 80, 90% full on average. And so, yeah, there are people who aren't getting to where they go, at least when they want to get there. This is disruptive.
Yeah, no doubt. One of the reasons for the cancellations we're seeing is a staffing crunch. Americans having some trouble getting enough pilots and flight attendants to fly on these airplanes. Why is that? Is this the same labor issue that we've seen across the economy?
It is to a degree, but don't forget that these airlines begged people a year ago to please retire early. They offered them all kinds of incentives. Mm-hmm. They thought this was perhaps going to be a very protracted recovery. Instead, you've had this surge in demand. Now, for perspective, there's 132 flights, Peter, that compares to 4 flights for United today and 3 flights for Delta. So for anybody thinking, well, is it just all the airlines? No. That's also more than half the cancellations into and out of the United States today, even though American accounts for far less than half the flights. American, Peter, is back up to a greater percentage of its schedule than Delta and United, its primary competitor. So it's down just 14% from where it was a year ago, according to Cirium schedule data, whereas Delta and United are both down about 30%. So if you think about that, American's kind of pushing it, trying to get back up in the air more quickly, and that could be contributing to this greater shortage of at least employees relative to what it's trying to fly.
Demand for flying is up, and now I wonder if the cancellations are creating something of a supply issue. In other words, are prices going to go up?
Yeah, and they are for a few reasons. Number one, you said just very simple supply and demand economics. And number two, the fact that, remember, business travelers mostly aren't traveling right now. And Peter, the way it usually works is business travelers subsidize leisure travelers, right? They pay more. The fares are higher. You can't fill a whole plane with them, so airlines then sell the rest of the seats, you know, because they'd rather get something than nothing. But right now, they kind of have to make all their money just on leisure travelers. So when you don't have somebody paying, you know, $800 or $1,000 to fly to Chicago, maybe, then you can't have other people paying $100 or $150. And so that's kind of squeezing leisure travelers, too, when they go on vacation.
All right. Well, flying continues to be tough, not so much fun. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And if you're still not ready to get on a plane this summer, you might be getting behind the wheel of your car instead. But be careful, because the roads have been more dangerous lately. The National Safety Council says more than 42,000 people died in car crashes last year. That's up 8% from the year before. Now, some cities are taking note, and they're trying to do something about it. Kansas City, Missouri is among those adopting a Vision Zero plan to reach zero traffic deaths by 2030. The city manager, Brian Platt, joins us now. Brian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what were you seeing on the streets of Kansas City that pushed city leaders towards this goal of zero traffic deaths?
Well, Vision Zero and this approach is nothing new to Kansas City or any city across the country, and it's something that the council and stakeholders in this city have been talking about for quite a while. We were seeing an increase in traffic fatalities and serious injuries, particularly over the last 10 years, about 20% increase. The pandemic actually made it a little more obvious and evident. We did have a little bit of a spike, we think, because there was less traffic on the roads and an easier opportunity to speed and to engage in dangerous behavior. And so it became all the more urgent to put this at the top of the priority list.
Okay. And so what does it look like? What does zero fatalities look like on the street level? How do you do it?
There are a few things we can do. One of them is we can do what's called a curb extension. It shortens the distance of travel between the two sidewalks. It shortens the distance where pedestrians and cyclists may have an opportunity to interact with a vehicle. We can adjust the traffic signal timing as well. That actually makes all of the signals red for a short amount of time to give pedestrians and anyone walking through or cycling through an intersection a little bit of a head start. A lot of the crashes occur right at the corner where visibility is the lowest for vehicles and for pedestrians. Getting those pedestrians out into the center of the street actually makes them more visible to cars and reduces the chances for that type of interaction.
What does all that mean for traffic backups? Does that mean that it's going to be a lot slower if you're in a car?
There's a potential, but for the most part, we do a lot of studying and engineering of the intersections and the treatments that we're looking to pursue to make sure that we're not significantly impacting travel times. And what you'll find a lot of is that it doesn't necessarily impact travel times for the most part. It just limits the ability of drivers and cyclists to go too fast or to be too dangerous and reckless in some of those intersections and areas where there's potential for conflict.
Well, look, it sounds really good, and a lot of cities around the country are doing the exact same thing, or their own version of it. Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., New York City, they've all done this over the last couple of years, and the results have been mixed. I mean, look at New York. Reduced traffic fatalities over the course of 4 years after doing Vision Zero, but then they're starting to rise again. Austin, Texas, things are actually getting worse now that they've started this plan. I think it's a similar story in Los Angeles. So why aren't these programs always doing their intended job?
It's hard to look at the high-level data at a citywide perspective and see the change. And that's because a lot of these treatments occur at a very hyper-local level. They're occurring at specific intersections. They're occurring along specific corridors. And when you look at those corridors, you look at those intersections, the data does show that vehicle speeds are reducing, that the number of crashes are reducing, that the number of fatalities are reducing.
It sounds like what you're saying, though, is that it might be necessary to do these sorts of mitigation efforts and these changes at intersections and along roads across the entire city to get to the point that you're hoping to, which is zero.
Correct. And we hope that these types of implementations and redesigns will be the new standard, that no longer will we have to go back to intersections and revisit them and make tweaks to traffic signal timing or the location of the curb line, that from now on, curbs, intersections, and traffic signal setups and all of the things that make our streets what they are will be designed with a new approach from the beginning.
If you are a black person in the United States, you are more likely to die in a traffic accident. That is true in your city. It is true in cities across the country. What are you going to do about that?
Equity is a significant component of this, as is any initiative that we do in Kansas City. And one of the things that we're trying to make sure we're focusing on is that the implementations and improvements are spread across the city in the most equitable and fair way possible. That includes a few different things. One is that just from a geographic perspective, making sure that we're covering all neighborhoods across the city. But the other is that we're doing enough community engagement and feedback to make sure that we're hearing from the people who are using the streets the most and understanding exactly where the challenges are in each particular neighborhood. It's not up to us to say this is a location that's more dangerous than another one. We're using data, we're using feedback, and we're using an equitable, broad approach to making sure that we're doing implementations in all neighborhoods.
Zero traffic deaths sounds a little unrealistic, although, of course, I hope you could do it. I mean, but what do you think? I mean, can you really?
I think it's an aspirational goal, but it is certainly feasible if all the right measures are put in place. It will take a long time to get through every single intersection in the city. We have 318 square miles. We have 6,000 lane miles of streets in Kansas City. You can imagine how long it takes just to do one intersection. So it is a long-term goal. But on the other side of it, you know, I don't think there's a city out there that would say, let's set a goal of only 10 deaths a year or 20 deaths a year. I don't think that anyone would ever want to set a goal that doesn't quite get all the way there.
Brian Platt is the city manager for Kansas City, Missouri, trying to get that city down to zero traffic deaths by the year 2030. Brian, good luck. I hope you get there. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
This month marks the 50th anniversary of the war on drugs in the U.S. We've hit this milestone at a moment when overdose deaths are higher than ever. Drug deaths spiked more than 25% in the 12-month period ending last August. That's according to the White House and CDC data. And public health officials say there are proven harm reduction strategies to help people with addiction stay alive. But those programs face a growing backlash. Today, we re-air this report from NPR's Brian Mann.
Shanna Dameron has struggled with addiction since she was a teenager. Alcohol first, now heroin and methamphetamines. She says using drugs is more deadly than ever. That's because much of the supply of street drugs is contaminated with the potent synthetic opioid fentanyl.
I mean, that fentanyl is no joke. And it's just a split second, you know. And every time we stick a needle in our arm, we're taking a 50-50 chance. You know, we could die.
Dameron says there's also high risk of disease from contaminated needles shared by drug users. Her community, Cabell County, West Virginia, has seen a major HIV/AIDS outbreak.
Like, I don't know if I have any friends that's not positive for HIV. I mean, every one of us are. I am too.
Harm reduction advocates say these outcomes are avoidable. Louise Vincent runs a program in Greensboro, North Carolina, where people can get clean needles and test their street drugs for contamination. Vincent says this works. It keeps people safer. But services like hers are banned in much of the country.
You know, I guess we have to decide as a community and as a society, is it okay to just let people that use drugs die? Is that really what we're comfortable with?
Under the drug war model in place since the 1970s, Americans who use illegal drugs are often treated as criminals. Many of the nation's top drug addiction researchers say evidence is now clear that approach didn't work. One alternative would be to treat people with addiction like patients with a chronic disease. That could mean offering drug users a safe supply of their drug of choice, along with supervised consumption sites where they can be protected from overdoses, meanwhile guiding them toward treatment and health care. That approach is being tried in parts of Australia, Canada, and Portugal. But in much of the U.S., addiction policy is moving in the opposite direction. Again, Louise Vincent in North Carolina.
I would be naive to say that this is well accepted. We just defeated a bill that was trying to, that would have shut down most programs.
In recent months, officials in parts of the U.S. devastated by addiction have rolled back harm reduction programs. Local leaders in Scott County, Indiana, voted to shut down a needle exchange that helped slow a major HIV outbreak among drug users. Lawmakers in West Virginia, where the opioid epidemic is still widespread, approved a similar measure. Dr. Michael Kilkenny, who heads the Public Health Department in Cabell County, West Virginia, says the new law will dissuade towns from offering clean needles even when there's clear medical need.
New setups are going to be remarkably restricted. Communities that were on the fence, they've been knocked off the fence in the wrong direction.
some forms of harm reduction are more accepted now. Many communities distribute naloxone among people who use drugs. It's a medication that can reverse overdoses caused by fentanyl and other opioids. But public health experts tell NPR much of the harm reduction happening in the U.S. occurs underground, with services provided illegally by churches, nonprofits, and activist groups. Keith Humphreys, an addiction researcher at Stanford University, says it also appears many doctors are quietly keeping their patients safe by prescribing opioids to people addicted to pain pills.
There are plenty of physicians who make the decision that, well, I wish this person weren't taking such a very high doses, but I know that if I pull them away, they might go out and start using heroin. It's not perfect, but it's better than the alternative. And that kind of thinking is really central to the concept of harm reduction.
There's also pressure on doctors to prescribe more buprenorphine. It's a medication that can reduce opioid cravings, preventing relapses and overdoses. But harm reduction advocates say most Americans don't have access to that kind of treatment or safe drug supply. That's especially true for people who are poor and homeless, like Shanna Dameron, who says she has no choice but to go to the streets for her heroin.
I take my chance with my 50-50 shot of whether it's going to kill me.
The U.S. saw more than 90,000 fatal overdoses last year, a 30% increase. If current trends continue, drugs will soon kill more Americans every day than COVID-19. Brian Mann, NPR News.
And tomorrow we continue NPR's series on the 50th anniversary of the war on drugs with a look at the long-term challenges of addiction recovery. In Massachusetts, community corrections program is aimed to keep drug users out of prison and treat addiction as a disease.
Some people might think, oh, well, that's being soft with crime. But if you know somebody that struggled with substance use disorder, you know that pursuing your recovery is not something that's easy or soft.
The anniversary of the war on drugs, all this week on Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.